reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, July 25th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. We'll start on the first page today. The first article is headlined, Teed Off Against Violence, Sixth Annual Golf Tourney Fundraiser to Support Violent Crime Victims, by Kelby Wingert. A program that provides resources to survivors of violent crimes and their families is hosting a golf tournament to raise funds to help support its mission next weekend. The sixth annual Teed Off Against Violence golf tournament, sponsored by the Homicide Other Violent Crimes Program and the Domestic Sexual Assault Outreach Center, will be August 6th at Lakeside Municipal Golf Course. The event will kick off the night before with a concert and silent auction at the Moose Lodge, 424 First Avenue South, from 7 to 10 p.m. The Chris Carr Band will perform, and the live music is free and open to the public. The fundraiser is paramount to supporting the Homicide Other Violent Crimes Program, Program Director Marie Harvey said. The program, which serves a 15-county region, has faced many budget cuts in recent years, so this fundraiser helps fill in the gaps. Our services range from crisis intervention to court hearings to counseling, Harvey said. Oftentimes, their support comes in the form of gas cards, restaurant gift cards, and hotel lodging for victims of violent crimes who have to travel to attend court and trial proceedings for their case. It's kind of any expense that they incur due to being a victim of crime, Harvey said. We've paid utility bills sometimes, helped with school supplies, kind of whatever they're needing. And if we can't do it, we'll find the right resource. The HOVC aims to raise at least $20,000. Last year's tournament brought in about $15,000, Harvey said. We really want to make this the best one ever this year, she said. Most people in the communities Harvey and her staff serve have never heard of Homicide Other Violent Crimes Program. And that's a good thing, she said, because it means they've never had to use their services. But still, Harvey is hoping to bring more awareness to the program and how it helps, in hopes of finding more financial support. Next weekend's golf tournament is a four-person best ball format. It will have a 9 a.m. shotgun start, and there will be mini games on some of the holes. Cash prizes will be at stake. A second silent auction, with different items than the August 5th silent auction, will run most of the day in the clubhouse at Lakeside. The silent auction will be open to the public, not just golfers in the tournament, Harvey said. New this year will be an online auction for supporters who may not be able to make the events. All three auctions will have different items, and details can be found on the event's Facebook page. This golf tournament is about more than just raising money. It's about raising awareness, Harvey said. Each golf cart will have a shield that has the story of someone lost to violence. The number of individuals and families served by the HOVC program have skyrocketed in recent years, Harvey told the Messenger, ahead of last year's tournament. In 2020, the program served around 350 clients, and in 2021, it served 630 clients. So far in 2022, 302 clients have been served by HOVC. There are still spots open in the tournament. When spots are filled, there will be a wait list in case of any cancellations. To sign up, call 515-955-5677. More photos of the auction items can be found on Facebook, Teed Off Against Violence Annual Golf Tournament. Also on today's front page, construction begins on Fort Dodge Fiber. Conduit Cabinets to be Placed in Central Zone of City, by Kelly Bloomquist. Construction crews will begin breaking ground this week on Fort Dodge Fiber, the city's new municipal broadband network. Five directional boring crews will begin digging to place orange conduit to build a fiber ring. According to Jeremy Pearson, director of Fort Dodge Fiber, this ring will be used to create a redundant fiber connection beginning and ending at a data center, which will be housed inside the municipal building. Vaults and handholds will also be placed in the ground to allow Fort Dodge Fiber the ability to store extra cable slack for future fiber maintenance. 37 above-ground cabinets will also be strategically placed around the city to service homes and businesses. Once the conduit, cabinets, vaults, and handholds are placed, the crews will then pull the actual fiber cable through the conduit and start splicing, said Pearson. These directional boring crews will be working in the right-of-way where other underground utilities are located. Various utility locators will also be outmarking existing underground utilities and marking them to avoid potential damage. It is always our goal to minimize disruptions in residents' normal day-to-day activities, but with construction like this, there may be some temporary disruptions to traffic and sidewalks, said Pearson. Everyone involved in the project will do our best to keep those disruptions to a minimum. The construction of the fiber ring is anticipated to only take place in the public right-of-way and should not involve residential properties at this time. When Fort Dodge Fiber begins bringing fiber drops to homes and businesses later this year, a site visit will be requested with the property owner to understand any obstacles that may be encountered, such as irrigation lines, invisible pet fences, old cisterns, or septic tanks. These site visits should alleviate most issues, but we are installing miles and miles of fiber optic cable, and there will always be something that happens, said Pearson. We will do our best to minimize those issues throughout the entire build process. According to Pearson, the fiber ring is the first piece of the construction project, and since the data center is located at the municipal building, construction will begin there. Inside of our City Hall data center, you'll find all of the equipment needed to make the network function, said Pearson. Our main connections to the internet will be terminated there. Our servers, switches, and routers to direct traffic from homes and businesses to the internet will be housed in the data center. As the fiber ring slowly gets built out from this location, the cabinets around City Hall will be the first to be installed. While directional boring crews will begin construction work this week, actual hookups to homes and businesses are anticipated to still take some time. There are still a lot of things that need to happen, said Pearson. Our first internet connection to support our customers is not expected to be installed until sometime in mid-August. We have an aggressive construction timeline, but the goal of Fort Dodge Fiber has been to have between 200 and 300 customers hooked up by the end of 2022. Residents interested in Fort Dodge Fiber services are asked to register their interest for a free fiber drop online at fortdodgefiber.com. Registering does not obligate residents to sign up for services. According to Pearson, during the main construction phase, a fiber drop will not cost the home or business owner, but allows the city to prepare for potential service in the future. We can't wait for this construction to start, said Pearson. The fiber ring will be the backbone of the entire network throughout the city of Fort Dodge. Once we start putting the conduit and fiber in the ground, we are just that much closer to delivering an ultra-fast fiber optic network to every home and business in the city of Fort Dodge. And the last item on today's front page is headlined, "To Hunt or Not, FD Council to Consider First Urban Deer Hunt," by Bill Shea. After years of hearing residents complain about deer gobbling up gardens and nearly causing crashes on the streets, the Fort Dodge City Council will decide this evening if bow hunters should be allowed to thin out the herd. The council will hold a workshop discussion on a potential urban hunting season, which would not begin until September 2023. Then the council will consider a measure that would approve the deer hunting season. That measure would have to be approved 3 times to authorize a hunt. The council activity will begin at 5:30 p.m. today in the municipal building, 819 First Avenue South, with a workshop discussion on the potential urban-controlled bow hunting ordinance. The council's business meeting will begin at 6 p.m. in the municipal building. During that session, the council will vote on the first reading of the deer hunt ordinance. If it is eventually approved by the council, the hunt will still have to be approved by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Any hunt would be archery only. An approved deer hunt would not be an open season anywhere in the city. Hunting could only be done on about 3,200 acres on the northern, eastern, and western edges of town. Any hunters wishing to take part would have to be approved by the Department of Natural Resources and the Police Department. Complaints about deer have come to the council off and on for decades. In January 2020, the City Council received a petition signed by 307 people asking that the local government prepare a plan to reduce the deer population in the city. In August 2020, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources staffers advised the council that an archery hunt to thin out the deer herd in the city could be conducted. Such a hunt would target female deer, called does. Then in June 2021, the city set up a system by which residents could send a text to report deer sightings. There is a picture feature on page 2 titled Bringing Shrek to the Stage. I'll read the captions on the pictures. Melanie Buttrick of Fort Dodge stars as the dragon during Stage Door Productions' version of Shrek Jr. the Musical on Saturday at the Fort Dodge Middle School. Briley Singer of Fort Dodge plays the role of Princess Fiona during Stage Door Productions' version of Shrek Jr. the Musical on Saturday at the Fort Dodge Middle School. Michael Campbell, Left, and Erin Amhoff, both of Fort Dodge, star as Donkey and Shrek, respectively, during the production. Owen Hamlow of Fort Dodge plays the role of Lord Farquaad during the production at Fort Dodge Middle School. Here's a feature item from page 6. Attorney wins Ernest Hemingway contest in Key West tradition. Key West, Florida, by the Associated Press. Some came in wool fishermen sweaters, and other contestants had sportsman's attire, but it was the cream-colored sweater of attorney John Auvel that caught the eye of judges, who awarded him the title for most resembling author and former Key West resident Ernest Hemingway. Auvel triumphed Saturday night over 124 other contestants for the title in the annual Hemingway Lookalike Contest at Sloppy Joe's Bar, the Key West establishment where the author was a regular patron during his decade-long residence on the island in the 1930s. The Lookalike Contest is a highlight of Key West's annual Hemingway Days celebration, which ended Sunday. Auvel said he shares Hemingway's passion for fishing, has written some fiction, and would like to do more writing. "Every man wants to write like Hemingway," said Auvel, who lives in Dade City, Florida. Moving to today's editorial page, here is the Messenger editorial for today. It is titled, "Iowa's Fruit and Vegetable Growers Deserve Recognition. They grow healthy food, generate economic impact." There's more than corn and soybeans growing in Iowa's rich soil. Iowa's farmers grow staggering amounts of corn and soybeans, so it makes sense that those crops are the first ones many people associate with the state's farms. But there is also a surprising amount of fruits and vegetables grown in Iowa. To recognize that fact, Governor Kim Reynolds has proclaimed this week as Iowa Fruit and Vegetable Week. The proclamation states in part that local Iowa fruit and vegetable producers receive support and recognition for their achievements by celebrating this week across Iowa. Fruits and vegetables raised by the state's professional horticulture industry contribute $48 million to the state's economy every year. According to a recent statewide survey, the top fruit and vegetable crops in Iowa are tomatoes, pumpkins, cucumbers, green beans, and winter squash. There are 1,084 Iowa farms growing vegetables and 1,714 farms growing fruits, according to the most recent U.S. agricultural census. Unless you have your own garden, you're not going to get fruits and vegetables that are more local than those grown on Iowa farms. Elsewhere in the United States, people may talk about the wonders of farm-to-table produce. Here in Iowa, we have it and we should take advantage of it. That $48 million annual contribution to the Iowa economy is just as healthy in its own way as the fresh fruits and vegetables themselves. We salute Iowa's fruit and vegetable growers and urge everyone to support them by buying fresh, healthy produce. Also on today's editorial page is a column by nationally syndicated columnist Rich Lowry. It's titled, "Joe Biden's Bogus Climate Emergency." Word has come down from on high that it is now mandatory to refer to climate change as an emergency. Democrats and climate activists are urging President Joe Biden to declare a literal emergency to unlock powers allowing him to enact new measures without congressional approval. Congressional action to address the climate crisis appears to have stalled, Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and other Democratic senators wrote Biden. "As a result, we urge you to put us on an emergency footing and aggressively use your executive powers to address the climate crisis." That 51 senators oppose adopting legislation favored by Jeff Merkley might be a disappointment to Jeff Merkley, but it's not warrant for unilateral presidential rule. James Madison would have been shocked and appalled that members of the legislative branch now routinely lobby for presidents to govern without them. But the nation's legislators have lost their constitutional bearings and sense of self-respect. While Biden has stopped short of such a declaration, at least for now, he used the word emergency in a speech announcing new executive actions and called climate change an existential threat to our nation. The latest dire rhetoric is being driven by a heat wave in Europe and here at home that is being hyped for all it's worth. London smashed records, but after a couple of days of remarkably elevated temperatures, the highs are forecast to be mostly in the 70s in the next couple of weeks, warm by the city's standard, but not catastrophic. News outlets and people tweeted about London burning during the hottest day because there was an outbreak of mostly grass fires. Somehow the city that had endured the blitz managed to persevere. A piece in the London Spectator pointed out that in actuality, all fires, including grass fires and other so-called secondary fires, have been drastically declining in Greater London for years. If heat waves become more frequent, as expected, Western European countries will have to more fully embrace air conditioning, which is our best tool against extreme heat. Places like Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Miami prove it is possible to be quite hot and also thriving and heavily populated. As for the high temperatures across a broad swath of the U.S., as Roger Pielke, Jr. of the University of Colorado Boulder has noted, heat waves were worse in the 1920s and 1930s. This doesn't mean that climate change isn't real and to some significant extent anthropomorphic, but that's not a reason to suspend all rational thought. It's one thing to invoke emergency presidential powers to respond to a terror attack or pandemic. It's another to do it because the temperature in Boston is over 90 degrees. The climate simply is not an urgent threat, demanding and susceptible to action right away. The warming of the planet is a long-fuse phenomenon that has built up steadily over time. There's been a 1.1 degree Celsius rise in the global temperature since the late 19th century, and won't soon be affected even by radical steps. If enacted in full, the Green New Deal would have a negligible effect on the global temperature. Nor is there an existential threat to the U.S. The idea that an advanced 21st century society that, unlike Western Europe, is already prodigiously air-conditioned, can't deal with additional heat during the summer, or for that matter, more adverse weather events, is laughable. The U.S. is a wealthy, innovative, and a continental nation where patterns of settlement have vastly changed over time and will continue to do so, regardless of the temperature trends. We will be able to adapt to and mitigate any harmful effects from climate change better than any other society in the world. President Biden is given to optimistic riffs about all that America can achieve. It is capable of anything, he believes, except surviving a warmer climate. He should have more faith in his country's resourcefulness and in its constitutional system. Again, that is a column by nationally syndicated columnist Rich Lowry on the editorial page of today's Messenger. And we'll now move to the This Date in History feature on page 2. Today is Monday, July 25th, the 206th day of 2022. There are 159 days left in the year. On July 25th, 1972, the notorious Tuskegee syphilis experiment came to light as the Associated Press reported that for the previous four decades, the U.S. Public Health Service, in conjunction with the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, had been allowing poor, rural black male patients with syphilis to go without treatment, even allowing them to die, as a way of studying the disease. On this date in 1866, Ulysses S. Grant was named General of the Army of the United States, the first officer to hold the rank. In 1946, the United States detonated an atomic bomb near Bikini Atoll in the Pacific in the first underwater test of the device. In 1956, the Italian liner SS Andrea Doria collided with the Swedish passenger ship Stockholm off the New England coast late at night and began sinking. 51 people, 46 from the Andrea Doria, 5 from the Stockholm, were killed. The Andrea Doria capsized and sank the following morning. And now here is today's Dear Annie column. Boyfriend's father taking his anger out on me. Dear Annie, I'm a 45-year-old woman and my boyfriend is 36. His family loves me except for his dad. I don't know what I have done for him to dislike me. I should say that at one point in the past, he used to like me. When my boyfriend's mom was diagnosed with cancer, I was there each time she was in the hospital. My boyfriend and I would take turns with his dad staying at the hospital overnight so she was never alone. When she was sent home from hospice, I quit working and spent a month at their home taking care of her, including cooking and cleaning. I would help give her medicine, and when neither of them could give her a bath, I did it. When she did pass, I was the one making everyone comfortable and helping with breakfast and dinner for 10 to 15 people every day up until the funeral. I even stayed another week after to make sure my boyfriend and his dad were okay. Whenever I would see his father, I would say hi and ask how he was doing, but he would just ignore me and give me a "how dare you speak to me" look. I'm now to the point where I just don't want to be around him. Last time my boyfriend went to his dad's for a gathering, he invited me, but I turned him down. I explained that I know I am not welcome there by his father. Why would I put myself in that uncomfortable situation? but I did tell him to go and have fun. I don't know why his dad dislikes me so much, and whenever my boyfriend asks, he just rolls his eyes. It makes it difficult for me when I go to his other relatives for holidays because of his father being there and knowing he hates me. I never stay long because he makes me feel unwanted. What can I do? What should I do? Signed, Dazed with Confusion. Dear Dazed with Confusion, you can't control how he treats you, but you can control how you react to him. Understand that this man lost his wife. He is probably grieving tremendously. It is possible that he associates you with his wife's death and is taking out his pain on you. Is it fair to you? No, not at all. But the understanding that he is acting rude or mean toward you will hopefully help you gain some perspective and not take it so personally. It might also be worth having a direct conversation with him yourself and just acknowledge his loss and ask him if there is anything you can do to become friends again. Dear Annie, please accept my expertise here from a 35-year career as a children's clinical counselor and school counselor. Bruises left on a child is not an ambiguous issue. A grandmother wrote to you about bruises she had seen on her grandchildren, and they blamed their mother. You recommended talking to her son, the father of the children, and if there was no improvement, to report them. As an expert in this field, I can tell you that while the grandmother is not what the law calls a mandated reporter of child abuse, she knows there is consistent abuse and there have been bruises. You should have told her to call protective services. She should also call the children's school and ask for the counselor or principal if there's no counselor and report what she knows. Her son is in failure to protect situation, and he is not the person to leave decisions up to or rely on to stop the abuse. He is in a codependent position with this angry, dominating mother. Signed, Protective Services. Dear Protective, thank you for your professional opinion. I agree with everything you say, including that I was ambiguous in my advice. The grandmother had written, I think reporting on their mother would make the situation worse, and I was trying to accommodate her fear. But in the end, the children come first, and I very much appreciate your letter. That is the end of today's column. And here's today's letter in Hints from Heloise, titled, Don't Be a Litter Bug. Today's sound off is about littering. Dear Heloise, on the 4th of July, my family and I went to a state park to have a picnic and cookout. I was completely disgusted by the amount of trash that littered the site. Trash cans overflowing, other families throwing trash on the ground or just letting it sit on a picnic table as they drove off. We left and went home. The following weekend, I took my kids to the lake and there was trash littering the beach area. We collected some of it and threw it in the bins provided by the state. Why are people so lazy that they can't enjoy the beauty of nature and keep beaches and parks litter-free? Unless their mothers work for the Park Service and are willing to clean up after these slobs, it would benefit all of us if people would clean up after themselves. I've traveled all over the world and can tell you that most other countries, such as those in Europe, Iceland, and Canada, take very good care of public parks. You don't see the trash and graffiti that you see here in America. There's no excuse for this kind of mess. Signed, Leah and Jacob L., Daytona Beach, Florida. Leah and Jacob, I agree with you. Public places should be kept attractive and clean. Unfortunately, we have people who are very careless about trashing these beautiful places, even with less consideration for others. The best thing to do is to set a good example and dispose of your litter in a trash can or in a bag in your car that you can toss in your trash can at home. It's up to each of us to keep America looking clean and well cared for. Signed, Heloise. Dishwasher Dilemma. Dear Heloise, I hate using my dishwasher and would like to wash my dishes by hand. My problem is my husband, who wants me to use the dishwasher. It poses a dilemma in this house. He says it's better to use the dishwasher at least once a week and hates it when I wash by hand. Why do I need to use my dishwasher? June W., Kinston, North Carolina. June, sorry, your husband is correct. You need to use your dishwasher to help keep it in good working order. You also use less water with today's water and energy-efficient dishwashers. Now with utility bills going sky high, it's important to be stingy with water and energy. A dishwasher also kills germs in water so hot that it would scald your hands. Your husband wins on this one. And we'll fill our half hour with a feature story that was in Sunday's Cedar Rapids Gazette regarding the Iowa power grid. The headline is, Hot This Summer? Here's How Power Grid Is Handling It, by Brittany Miller. Heat waves have rippled across the United States this summer, pouring hot, humid air into regions throughout the country. more than 100 million people were under heat-related warnings and advisories last week. Over this weekend and into Tuesday, the feels-like temperatures were expected to reach the triple digits in Midwestern states. The record-breaking summer warmth spurs sweaty communities to crank up their air conditioners, and power grids are straining. Iowa's energy, along with that of 14 other states and a Canadian province, is managed by Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, commonly known as MISO. According to an energy reliability assessment from a nonprofit regulatory authority released in May, MISO is at high risk of energy emergencies this summer because of anticipated energy shortfalls in its north and central regions. What does that mean, and how has that played out this summer so far? Here's what you need to know about how your energy is faring in the sweltering heat. In April, MISO announced a projected energy shortfall among the 11 Midwestern states in the organization's north and central regions amid warmer than normal temperatures. The utilities between zones 1 through 7, including parts of Iowa, couldn't offer enough energy to meet the summer peak forecast of 124 gigawatts. We've been seeing this trend for the past few years, but this summer's assessment and capacity auction reflect the potential for the tightest conditions we've experienced, MISO spokesman J. Hermachisky said. Capacity auctions are when MISO members disclose how much energy they can provide in order to meet demand. The 1.2 gigawatt deficit in meeting the peak demand forecast can be rectified by importing power from other regions or by managing the load, that is, decreasing energy demands through voluntary programs that curtail customers' energy use in exchange for cheaper rates. But the shortfall puts consumers in those regions at slightly higher risks of temporary outages. These increased risks come as the electric grid endures a transformation never before seen, Hermachinsky said. Readily available fossil fuel generation like coal is being replaced by weather-dependent renewable resources that can't operate 24/7. In eastern Iowa, for instance, Alliant Energy's Lansing Generating Station will be retired by year's end and replaced by increasing wind and solar generation. This renewable energy is cheaper and more environmentally sound than fossil fuels, but there need to be transmission line upgrades to ensure its dependability across the grid, said Ian Dobson, an engineering professor at Iowa State University. MISO consumers also are using more electricity for their heating needs and electric vehicles, changing daily and seasonal peak energy demands. All the while, more frequent and severe extreme weather is battering the grid. You must be very aware of the climate change kind of worsening of extreme weather, Dobson said. That is an issue for the electricity supply. Extending the transmission system that crisscrosses through MISO's regions is one element of the organization's plan to address the changing energy landscape. Its first long-range transmission portfolio will be proposed to the MISO Board of Directors next week, Hermachinsky said. The plan includes 18 transmission projects throughout MISO's north and central regions with a price tag of $10.3 billion. What has happened this summer so far? During the week of June 21st, when a heat wave crossed the country, MISO announced a warning that challenging conditions were expected because of high electricity demands from the heat. The declaration required utilities to delay any non-essential equipment maintenance and prepare emergency resources. Similar emergency alerts preceded and followed this announcement, asking members to keep an eye on grid conditions. Since May 1st, MISO has issued the following alerts and advisories, along with extensions that include Iowa. 7 conservative operations declarations, which indicate that there may be an issue with energy reliability in certain areas. 5 hot weather alerts, which signal that MISO could be approaching tight energy supply due to weather. 3 capacity advisories, which warn that operating capacities may be limited within the next few days. 3 maximum generation alerts, which mean that MISO is forecasting a potential energy shortage. MISO also issued 1 maximum generation warning May 12th that included Iowa, a step up from alerts and advisories. This notification prepares operators for the possibility that energy supplies may fall below normal operating practices. It isn't until a maximum generation event, the second step of MISO's emergency event levels, that there's an actual shortfall where energy supply is less than demand. Even with the alerts, warnings, and challenges, Iowans shouldn't fear their power will be involuntarily shut off. MISO hasn't gotten close to a maximum generation event this summer, Hermachinsky said. This does not mean consumers should expect the lights to go out in the MISO region this summer, he said. the overall stability and reliability of the system will not be compromised, as MISO will continue to implement any actions that may be necessary to prevent uncontrolled, cascading outages. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, July 25, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Ronald J. Ron Hickey, 78, of Farnhamville, passed away on Thursday, July 21, 2022, at Iowa Methodist Hospital in Des Moines. Celebration of Life will be on Friday, July 29, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Burial and graveside services will be at the Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter, Iowa, on Friday, August 5th at 9:30 a.m. with military rites. Survivors include his daughter, Beth Lenning, and her three children, Addison Lenning, Keaton, Amanda Lindstrom Lenning, and Caleb Lenning, son-in-law Chris Lenning, stepson Brian, Sherry McLeod, Greg, Connie McLeod, Mark, Maureen McLeod, stepdaughters Judy Rurup, Deborah, Ray, Prazak, 11 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his wife Marjorie Hickey, sister Elizabeth Hickey, brother Richard Hickey, grandson Jeremy McLeod, mother Jean Brownlee, mother-in-law Nellie Powell. Ronald John Hickey was born December 31, 1943 in Omaha, Nebraska. He was raised in rural Farnhamville by his grandparents John and Belle Schoberlein, where he attended Cedar Valley Schools, graduating in 1962. Ron was later drafted into the U.S. Army, serving during Vietnam from 1966 until his honorable discharge in 1968. He married Marjorie McLeod, and on November 8, 1969, and Ron stepped up to raise five stepchildren and their daughter Beth. Together they ran Panther Den, serving lunch at auctions for over 30 years from Hickey's lunch wagon. Ron was a carpenter all his life. To leave a condolence for the family or view full obit, LaufersweilerFuneralHome.com. Dale L. Seehusen. Dale L. Seehusen, age 66, of Pomeroy, passed away on Saturday, July 23, 2022, at Pocahontas Community Hospital in Pocahontas, Iowa. Funeral services 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 28, 2022, at Evangelical Covenant Church near Pomeroy, Iowa, with Pastor Grayson Dagenar officiating. Burial will be at Evangelical Covenant Cemetery near Pomeroy, Iowa. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, July 27, 2022, at Evangelical Covenant Church near Pomeroy. Powers Funeral Home of Pomeroy, Iowa, is handling the arrangements. For online condolences and obituaries, visit powersfh.net. J. A. Miller, age 71, of Pocahontas, passed away on Wednesday, July 20, 2022, at his home in Pocahontas, Iowa. Memorial service is 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 30, 2022, at the St. Peter Lutheran Church in Pocahontas, with Pastor John Meyer officiating. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, July 29, 2022, at the Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas, Iowa. Military rites by the Pocahontas American Legion. Burial will be held at a later date at Iowa Veterans Cemetery near Adel, Iowa. Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas is handling arrangements. For online condolences and obituaries, visit powersfh.net. Arlene R. Quinn, 82, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, July 20, 2022, at Trinity Regional Medical Center. A massive Christian burial will be 11 a.m. Friday, July 29, 2022, at Holy Trinity Church, with Monsignor Kevin McCoy officiating. Burial will follow in Corpus Christi Cemetery. A visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. And here are some death notices that are included in the Laufensweiler and Sievers ad on the obituary page. I will read the ones that were not included in today's obituary listings. Kenneth J. Photo, age 61, funeral Tuesday, 10:30 a.m., Holy Trinity Church. Visitation today, 4 to 7 p.m., Rosary 7 p.m. at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Deborah Debbie Edwards, age 67, celebration of life, Saturday, 11 a.m., Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Visitation 1 hour prior at the funeral home. Deanne M. Dunstan, age 70, services are pending. And that concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to sports, we'll start with the local headlines. Dodger trio, first team, all CIML Iowa. Adams, Bennett, Myers on top list. Wills Porter honored by Eric Pratt. No matter how successful the Fort Dodge softball program becomes, head coach Andy Adams hopes Dodger players and fans never take all-conference honors for granted, especially when two teams from the same league square off for the Class 5A championship, which has happened in each of the last two seasons. FDSH seniors Jalen Adams and Torrey Bennett are joined by freshman Mariah Myers on the 2022 All-CIML Iowa Conference first team. Senior Haley Wills and Lucy Porter made the second squad. The Dodgers and Waukee Northwest played last Thursday for the 5A title, with the Wolves prevailing. Northwest took the league crown by a half game over Fort Dodge, and the programs traded turns at the number one overall spot in the state's largest class after splitting the regular season series. Last year, the Dodgers faced Ankeny Centennial, another member of the seven-team Iowa division, for 5A supremacy. It's pretty remarkable when you think about it, Coach Adams said. To have both spots in the finals coming from our small division in back-to-back years, it really shows we've taken on the very best and held our own the whole time. This league has been a powerhouse. The level of talent and intensity was unmatched, but it also makes you appreciate just how hard it is to be on the all-conference list. It's a huge honor, and we will never downplay it or pretend like the recognition should be a given. This shows what your peers think of you. The other CIML coaches obviously have a great deal of respect for the fact that we made the finals in consecutive years. Adams logged a 23-4 pitching record for the Dodgers, 37-7 overall, 24 in the league. The University of Iowa recruit sported a .67 earned run average with 220 strikeouts in 157 innings. Opponents hit only 121 against her, and she walked just 15 batters. At the plate, Adams hit a team-best 488 with 7 home runs and 30 RBI. Bennett, also a future Iowa Hawkeye, batted 481 with 5 homers, 41 driven in, and 49 runs scored. She also stole 22 bases and didn't strike out once. Myers slugged an FDSH best 9 long balls with 18 doubles, 37 RBI, and a .476 average. The numbers speak for themselves when it comes to Jalen, Torrey, and Mariah, Coach Adams said. To put up those kinds of statistics against one of the top 10 schedules in the entire state, I'm just very proud of all of them. That goes without saying. They've done things the right way and worked incredibly hard to get to where they are today. People may think they're just naturals or they've always been the best players at their age levels. Not true. This is what years of determination and resilience looks like. Bennett and Adams are now 4-time first-team All-CIML honorees, with Myers earning back-to-back recognition. All three were on the All-State list in 2021 as well, and should be again when the Iowa Girls Coaches Association releases its squads later this week. Wills and Porter are repeat All-CIML Iowa members as well. Wills hit a career-best 350 with 41 RBI, 35 runs scored, and 21 steals. Porter led the Dodgers in RBI with 44, batting 363 while accumulating a 14-3 pitching record and a 2.24 ERA. Haley and Lucy were also very deserving, Adams said. They're first-team all-conference caliber players who just happened to be playing in the toughest league in the state. They were invaluable pieces to the puzzle this season. In so many ways, all of our kids were. Juniors Maggie Elsbecker and Lydia Lara joined freshman Mia McCaleb, on the honorable mention charts. All three outfielders were first-year starters. Elsbecker batted 321 while Lara hit 3 homers and drove in 21. McCaleb was above the 300 mark all season, drove in 27, scored 24 times, and stole 16 bases. We're really going to be counting on Maggie, Lydia, and Mia moving forward, Adams said. They've proven themselves as consistent varsity performers, which we desperately needed with our outfield being in transition a few months ago. Having all of them back in 2023 will be huge. Northwest was 35-7 overall and 23 in the division. The Wolves defeated Fort Dodge in the finals 2-0, making the third time they'd topped the Dodgers by 2 runs or less in 5 meetings this summer. Ankeny Centennial, 25-13, 13-9, and Ankeny, 27-13, 13-11, followed Northwest and FDSH in the standings, with Ames, Mason City, and Marshalltown rounding out the board. Adams, Bennett, Myers, Maddie Etzman, Waukee Northwest, Bailey Cole, Waukee Northwest, Mariah Parton, Ankeny, Ireland Buss, Ames, and Ellie Lynch, Ames, were unanimous selections. Continuing with local sports news, this is from the Area Roundup column. Twin Lakes Adult Triathlon and Duathlon. The 16th Annual Twin Lakes Triathlon and 9th Annual Twin Lakes Duathlon will take place on Saturday, August 13th. The adult events start at 7:30 a.m. with a 500-meter swim at the East Twin Lakes State Park. Then there is a double-loop 12.4-mile bike ride on blacktop roads around North Twin Lake. Participants finish with a 3.1-mile run on the trail, ending at the Bible Camp. For those participants who prefer to avoid the water, we offer a simultaneous duathlon, which substitutes a mile-and-a-half run for the swim. Individuals or teams of 2 to 3 people can enter the sprint triathlon, but only individuals can participate in the duathlon. Information is at twinlakesbiblecamp.org/triathlon. Registration closes on August 11th at 8 p.m. There is no same-day registration. The top three athletes in each age group and gender will receive a medal, plus the top three overall men, women, and team will receive a special award. The event put on by Twin Lakes Bible Camp with support by the Twin Lakes community. For more information, please contact P. Bennett at iowatelecom.net or Scott Larson at 712-297-7714. Info at twinlakesbiblecamp.com. Continuing with local sports news, FD's Flaherty brothers win youth tennis titles. Fort Dodge brothers Micah and Noah Flaherty both recently won youth tennis tournament championships. Micah, a sophomore-to-be at Fort Dodge Senior High, took the 16U Mississippi Valley Open title in Dubuque. He defeated number 3 seed Logan Sherman of Cedar Rapids 6-0-6-1. Lucas Burkamper of Cedar Rapids 6-1-6-0, Brecken Peterson of Sterling, Illinois 6-4-6-3, and number 4 seed Parami Sempat of Cedar Falls in the finals 6-2-6-0. Noah, who is entering 5th grade at Duncombe Elementary, defeated Maddox Carpenter of Urbandale 6-2, Annabelle Waddell of Urbandale 6-1, and Kyler Wilhaber of Urbandale 6-3 for the 10U Green Ball Tournament at the Des Moines Golf and Country Club. Moving on to national sports covered in today's paper, this is regarding the IndyCar race at Newton. It's titled Risky Business. Scary Moment for Newgarden, Award Emerges, by Jenna Fryer of the Associated Press. Newton, Iowa. Joseph Newgarden collapsed in the motorhome lot following his late crash Sunday at Iowa Speedway and was taken to a Des Moines hospital by helicopter for evaluation. IndyCar Medical Director Dr. Jeffrey Billows said Newgarden was transported by helicopter to Mercy One Des Moines Medical Center because the infield care center lacked the equipment to properly evaluate the Team Penske driver, who cut open the back of his head when he collapsed. Billows said Newgarden was awake and alert, but the hospital was a 45-minute drive from the track, and heavy traffic for the post-race Blake Shelton concert would have delayed the journey. Newgarden dominated and led 148 of the 300 laps while trying to sweep the weekend, but something on his Team Penske car broke with 64 laps remaining, and the 31-year-old Tennessee driver spun hard into the outside wall, creating an opening for Pato O'Ward of Arrow McLaren SP to win the race. Newgarden, a 2-time IndyCar champion, was visibly rattled after his mandatory check in the infield care center after the crash. "Definitely was a bit of a shot. I want to cry. So sad for my team. I don't know what happened," Newgarden said. "Everything felt fine to me. Totally unexpected, and it caught me by surprise. Team Penske is the best. I never have this stuff, so maybe we were due. We can't afford it for this year, but we'll fight back. We have a great team here." Chevrolet's initial diagnosis was that the suspension broke on Newgarden's car. There was no immediate word on the force in which Newgarden hit the outside wall. Billows said Newgarden cleared all tests in the care center after the crash, and the medical staff spoke to him a second time before he returned to the motorhome lot. IndyCar also had planned to reevaluate him Thursday in Indianapolis before he collapsed upon returning to the motorhome lot. Per IndyCar regulations, a driver receives a secondary evaluation when a crash registers more than 80 G-forces. There was no immediate word from IndyCar or Team Penske on the force of Newgarden's hit. "Thinking of my bus brother right now," tweeted Penske teammate Scott McLaughlin. O'Ward made the pass for the win on pit road with a speedy stop by his Arrow McLaren SP team, and held off Penske teammates Will Power and Scott McLaughlin. It's the second win of the season for the Mexican driver, who finished second on Saturday and remains firmly in the IndyCar title race with 5 races remaining. O'Ward is 5th in the standings, 36 points behind leader Marcus Ericsson. His win halted Team Penske's dominance on the 0.894-mile oval, where Roger Penske's drivers had won 6 of the last 7 races prior to Sunday. Scott Dixon of Chip Ganassi Racing finished 4th and was followed by teammate Jimmy Johnson, who raced hard with Indianapolis 500 winner Ericsson to earn his best finish through 2 seasons of IndyCar racing. Ericsson is also a Ganassi driver, and Newgarden's crash helped the Swede retain the lead in the IndyCar standings, making Johnson's aggressive racing a bit nerve-wracking for the Ganassi camp. Continuing with racing news, this one's titled Hamlin Prevails in NASCAR Race by Dan Gelston of the Associated Press. Long Pond, Pennsylvania. Denny Hamlin knocked his season-long nemesis out of the race during a late battle for the lead, then streaked ahead Sunday with the number 11 Toyota to become the winningest driver in Pocono Raceway history. The Joe Gibbs Racing driver won for the 3rd time this season and passed Hall of Fame driver Jeff Gordon for most wins at Pocono with 7. Hamlin swept 2 races at Pocono in his rookie season in 2006 and added wins in 2009, 2010, 2019, and 2020. Hamlin held off JGR teammate Kyle Busch, still looking for a new contract with Gibbs, to reach victory lane. Hamlin also tied Tony Stewart on the NASCAR's career wins list with 49. "I just wanted to be a local short track racer in Virginia. That's all I really cared about," Hamlin said. Hamlin first had to take out Trackhouse Racing driver Ross Chastain to clear his path down the stretch. Chastain wrecked Hamlin 2 times in a month earlier this season, prompting Hamlin to spew he had reached my peak with the aggressive driving of the watermelon farmer. Perhaps as payback, Hamlin refused to give his rival an inch off a late restart at Pocono and ran Chastain into the wall. Chastain slammed the wall and triggered a wreck that collected several drivers, including winless Kevin Harvick, who is fighting for a playoff spot. "What did you want me to do? What did you expect me to do?" Hamlin asked. Hamlin said he was at the end of it with his frustration with Chastain, but was mildly booed by the Pocono fans for denying them what could have been a thrilling battle to the checkered flag. Chastain, who has 2 wins this season, said he understands why he finished his race in the wall. "I think that's something that's been owed to me for a few months now," Chastain said. Hamlin got the last word, but does it squash their beef? Perhaps not. The wife of Chastain's race team owner, Justin Marks, tweeted, "Game on." Busch finished 2nd, followed by Chase Elliott, Tyler Reddick, and Daniel Suarez. Hamlin's win kept NASCAR with 14 drivers in the playoffs and 2 spots left over for the final 5 over the final 5 races before the field is set. Continuing with sports news, Mahomes only worried about winning. St. Joseph, Missouri, by the Associated Press. Patrick Mahomes walked onto the practice field at Missouri Western State University on Sunday, flanked by NFL rookies and longshots, many of whom dream of making in a year what the Chiefs quarterback will make by the end of the day. Yet when the Chiefs open the season in Arizona on September 11th, Mahomes won't even be the best-paid QB in the game. Yes, Mahomes set the market when he signed a 10-year, $450 million contract in July 2020, but that astonishing deal has been surpassed in average pay and guaranteed compensation multiple times over the past couple of years. And the latest to join the club with a skyrocketing quarterback contract is the Cardinals' Kyler Murray, whose 5-year, $230.5 million deal signed this week outpaces Mahomes in average pay by more than $1 million per year. All of which is fine for Mahomes, whose inherent humility means he doesn't mind seeing others get their due. "You want the salaries to keep going up, your players keep getting more and more," Mahomes said. "When I saw my deal, I knew I was going to be pretty set for life, regardless of what the market kind of patterns. But you just keep playing. Money is one thing, but when you get a Super Bowl ring in your career, that's the kind of thing you look back upon." This headline reads, Finau captures 3M championship. Blaine, Minnesota. After reading he was the betting favorite for the 3M Open, Tony Finau felt the pressure surprisingly mount in his mind as he sought to extend the momentum he has built this summer. Playing catch-up proved to be the right formula for his 3rd PGA Tour victory. Finau shot a 4-under-67 to win the 3M Open by 3 strokes Sunday, erasing a 5-stroke deficit with 11 holes left as Scott Piercy tumbled out of the lead down the stretch at Windy TPC Twin Cities. Finau finished at 17-under-267. Sung J.M., 68, and Emiliano Grillo, 71, tied for second place. Piercy followed his tournament record 54-hole score with a wince-inducing 76 to tie for fourth, four strokes back. James Hahn surged up the board with a 65 to match Piercy and Tom Hogue, 70, at 13-under. Pierce bogeyed four of six holes before a triple bogey implosion on number 14, allowing Finau to take over for good. Moving on to baseball news. Twins drub Tigers, Detroit. Sonny Gray allowed two hits in six innings to lead the Minnesota Twins to a 9-1 victory over the Detroit Tigers on Sunday. Gray, 5-3, is 2-0 against the Tigers this season, allowing one run on six hits in 13 innings. I'm pretty familiar with their lineup, which helps, but I think a lot of this was building on some good things I found in my last start before the break, he said. I was able to throw my fastball for strikes, and I was able to land my breaking ball where I needed it. Jose Miranda had three hits and scored twice for the Twins, who are 2-0 since the All-Star break. The bottom three hitters in Minnesota's order, Miranda, Gio Urshela, and Gary Sanchez, combined for six hits, five RBIs, and four runs. We've been talking about that all season, Twins manager Rocco Baldelli said. If you wait for your 1-2-3 hitters to get you going every game, you are going to have a lot of bad days. The bottom of our order has gotten us going a lot this year. The Twins took a 3-0 lead in the first with a little help from the Tigers. With one out, Carlos Correa singled and took third on Jorge Polanco's double. Max Kepler hit a grounder to second, but Correa beat Jonathan Schoop's throw to the plate. Cubs cap Philly sweep, Philadelphia, Associated Press. Yan Gomez hit two home runs, Drew Smyly tossed six sharp innings, and Chicago completed a three-game sweep of Philadelphia with a 4-3 win on Sunday. Nelson Velasquez also went deep for the Cubs, who have won four in a row. It was Chicago's first three-game sweep in Philadelphia since July 2000. Garrett Stubbs homered for the Phillies, who failed to gain ground in the NL wildcard race against the lowly Cubs. Only the Reds, Athletics, and Nationals entered the day with fewer wins than Chicago. White Sox 6, Guardians 3, Chicago. Dylan Cease threw six innings in his third straight scoreless start, Leury García and A.J. Pollock homered, and Chicago beat Cleveland to salvage a four-game split. Eloy Jimenez went deep in his second straight game, helping the White Sox end a series that was shaping up as a bad one for them on a stronger note. The reigning AL Central champions won the second game of Saturday's doubleheader after blowing a 3-0 lead. Royals 4, Rays 2, Kansas City, Missouri. Chris Bubik went seven strong innings, Hunter Dozier and MJ Melendez had late-inning RBIs, and Kansas City won a series against Tampa Bay for the first time in 5 years. Dozier snapped a two-all tie with two outs in the seventh when he singled off Brooks Raley, 1-1, to score Whit Merrifield. Melendez added an insurance run with a double in the eighth. Brewers 10, Rockies 9, Milwaukee. Andrew McCutchen's tie-breaking two-run double capped a two-out rally in the eighth inning that lifted Milwaukee over Colorado. Alex Colom, 2-3, came in to protect an 8-7 lead for the Rockies and retired the first two batters he faced before the Brewers broke loose. Rowdy Tellez hit a tying single that set the stage for McCutchen. Colorado, which had erased deficits of 3-0 and 5-2 earlier in the day, nearly came all the way back again. Brewers closer Josh Hader held on for his 28th save. Blue Jays 8, Red Sox 4, Boston. Raimel Tapia had three hits and drove in four runs, giving him 10 RBIs for the series, and Vladimir Guerrero had four hits as Toronto beat bumbling Boston for a three-game sweep. 2 days after Tapia had an inside-the-park grand slam and a record-setting 28-5 victory, he had a bases-loaded triple to spot Toronto to a 5-0 lead off top prospect Braven Bello. Yankees 6, Orioles 0, Baltimore. Aaron Judge hit his major league leading 37th home run. Fellow All-Star Nestor Cortes pitched six sharp innings, and the New York Yankees beat the Baltimore Orioles 6-0 on Sunday. Jose Trevino, another Yankees All-Star, produced a first four-game hit of his career. Reds 6, Cardinals 3, Cincinnati. Joey Votto hit a three-run homer to back Tyler Mahle's sharp return from injury as Cincinnati beat St. Louis. The last-place Reds overcame Paul Goldschmidt's two opposite-field homers. And now here are some items from the Hot Corner, which is this day in sports history. 1941, Lefty Grove of the Boston Red Sox wins his 300th and last game, beating the Cleveland Indians 10-6. 1976, in Montreal, Edwin Moses of the United States sets an Olympic record in the 400 hurdles with a time of 47.63. 1982, Janet Anderson wins the U.S. Women's Open Golf title, her first tournament victory. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, July 25th, 2022. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Thanks for listening.